Penguin Random House Audio presents Killers of the Flower Moon, The Osage Murders and the Birth of the FBI by David Gran. Read for you by Will Patton, Anne-Marie Lee, and Danny Campbell.
Chronicle 1. The Marked Woman. There had been no evil to mar that propitious night, because she had listened. There had been no voice of evil. No screech owl had quaveringly disturbed the stillness. She knew this because she had listened all night. John Joseph Matthews, Sundown. 1. The Vanishing. In April, millions of tiny flowers spread over the Blackjack Hills and vast prairies in the Osage Territory of Oklahoma. There are Johnny Jump-Ups and Spring Beauties and Little Bluets. The Osage writer John Joseph Matthews observed that the galaxy of petals makes it look as if the gods had left confetti. In May, when coyotes howl beneath an unnervingly large moon, taller plants, such as spiderworts and black-eyed Susans, begin to creep over the tinier blooms, stealing their light and water. The necks of the smaller flowers break, and their petals flutter away, and before long they are buried underground. This is why the Osage Indians refer to May as the time of the flower-killing moon. On May 24th, 1921, Molly Burkhart, a resident of the Osage settlement town of Gray Horse, Oklahoma, began to fear that something had happened to one of her three sisters, Anna Brown. 34 and less than a year older than Molly, Anna had disappeared 3 days earlier. She had often gone on sprees, as her family disparagingly called them, dancing and drinking with friends until dawn. But this time, one night had passed, and then another, and Anna had not shown up on Molly's front stoop as she usually did, with her long black hair slightly frayed and her dark eyes shining like glass. When Anna came inside, she liked to slip off her shoes, and Molly missed the comforting sound of her moving, unhurried, through the house. Instead, there was a silence as still as the plains. Molly had already lost her sister Minnie nearly 3 years earlier. Her death had come with shocking speed, and though doctors had attributed it to a peculiar wasting illness, Molly harbored doubts. Minnie had been only 27 and had always been in perfect health. Like their parents, Molly and her sisters had their names inscribed on the Osage roll, which meant that they were among the registered members of the tribe. It also meant that they possessed a fortune. In the early 1870s, the Osage had been driven from their lands in Kansas onto a rocky, presumably worthless reservation in northeastern Oklahoma, only to discover decades later that this land was sitting above some of the largest oil deposits in the United States. To obtain that oil, prospectors had to pay the Osage for leases and royalties. In the early 20th century, each person on the tribal roll began receiving a quarterly check. The amount was initially for only a few dollars, but over time, as more oil was tapped, the dividends grew into the hundreds, then the thousands, and virtually every year the payments increased, like the prairie creeks that joined to form the wide, muddy Cimarron, until the tribe members had collectively accumulated millions and millions of dollars. In 1923 alone, the tribe took in more than $30 million, the equivalent today of more than $400 million. The Osage were considered the wealthiest people per capita in the world. Lo and behold, the New York Weekly Outlook exclaimed, the Indian, instead of starving to death, enjoys a steady income that turns bankers green with envy. The public had become transfixed by the tribe's prosperity, which belied the images of American Indians that could be traced back to the brutal first contact with whites, the original sin from which the country was born. Reporters tantalized their readers with stories about the plutocratic Osage and the red millionaires with their brick and terracotta mansions and chandeliers, with their diamond rings and fur coats and chauffeured cars. One writer marveled at Osage girls who attended the best boarding schools and wore sumptuous French clothing as if une très jolie demoiselle of the Paris boulevards had inadvertently strayed into this little reservation town. At the same time, reporters seized upon any signs of the traditional Osage way of life, which seemed to stir in the public's mind visions of wild Indians. One article noted a circle of expensive automobiles surrounding an open campfire where the bronzed and brightly blanketed owners are cooking meat in the primitive style. Another documented a party of Osage arriving at a ceremony for their dances in a private airplane, a scene that outrivals the ability of the fictionist to portray. Summing up the public's attitude toward the Osage, the Washington Star said, "That lament, Lo, the poor Indian, might appropriately be revised to, Ho, the rich redskin." Gray Horse was one of the reservation's older settlements. These outposts, including Fairfax, a larger neighboring town of nearly 1,500 people, and Pawhuska, the Osage capital, with a population of more than 6,000, seemed like fevered visions. The streets clamored with cowboys, fortune seekers, bootleggers, soothsayers, medicine men, outlaws, U.S. marshals, New York financiers, and oil magnates. Automobiles sped along paved horse trails, the smell of fuel overwhelming the scent of the prairies. Juries of crows peered down from telephone wires. There were restaurants advertised as cafes and opera houses and polo grounds. Although Molly didn't spend as lavishly as some of her neighbors did, she had built a beautiful rambling wooden house in Gray Horse near her family's old lodge of lashed poles, woven mats, and bark. She owned several cars and had a staff of servants, the Indians' potlickers, as many settlers derided these migrant workers. The servants were often black or Mexican, and in the early 1920s, a visitor to the reservation expressed contempt at the sight of even whites performing all the menial tasks about the house to which no Osage would stoop. Molly was one of the last people to see Anna before she vanished. That day, May 21st, Molly had risen close to dawn, a habit ingrained from when her father used to pray every morning to the sun. She was accustomed to the chorus of meadowlarks and sandpipers and prairie chickens, now overlaid with the pock-pocking of drills pounding the earth. Unlike many of her friends, who shunned Osage clothing, Molly wrapped an Indian blanket around her shoulders. She also didn't style her hair in a flapper bob, but instead let her long black hair flow over her back, revealing her striking face with its high cheekbones and big brown eyes. Her husband, Ernest Burkhart, rose with her. A 28-year-old white man, he had the stock handsomeness of an extra in a Western picture show. Short brown hair, slate blue eyes, square chin. Only his nose disturbed the poor.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?